Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way. It's the podcast where the brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies, but not in a creepy way.
Spoiler alert.
Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
Are you ready to talk about 9 to 5?
Yeah.
Okay, so just give me your memories of this movie, if you can.
Well, I remember being introduced to this movie in the Albrecht's living room, watching it with Aaron on the Betamax that they had, which was in the upstairs living room, which was Reba and George's area, I think. Well, I think Reba and George's room were downstairs, and then Lee and Charlie's room were upstairs, but the kids moved upstairs, and so the living room was kind of upstairs, the second living room, if you will. And that's where the kids were, because I think Reba's living room was downstairs. So I remember being over there at the Albrecht's house and watching it. And I don't know why, but, watched it a couple times at the very least, probably every other time I was over there, I watched it. Inexplicably. Because this really wasn't, I would have been 8 years old. So not necessarily an age-appropriate movie, because there was some pretty adult stuff in it. It was, of course, hilarious to me as an eight-year-old. And then watched it at home. And now I think, I hadn't seen it in some time, because it doesn't really come up on, I don't really see it in cable very often. But I just have nothing but fond memories of, because it's a great movie from start to finish.
Oh, I think it's very well done. I have similar memories. I don't know whether I saw it first at the Albrechts, although that would make sense that I would have. But I know it must have been on Multivisions, or one of the cable channels that we got as Multivisions.
Right.
Because I remember it being, it was on all the time.
That could be very likely, because there wasn't a lot of movies on Multivisions, and so when they got new movies, they played the hell out of them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And if I remember correctly, because it was just like Showtime, even when we had Showtime, like in California, they played the same, they had like 5 or 6 new movies a month, and they just played the crap out of them.
Right.
So if you wanted to see them, you could see them every other day at various times of the day.
Right.
But this movie, and I bet you it was on TV a lot too, because there's not a lot of swearing, and there's some sexual innuendo, but there's no real sex in the movie.
No.
So, it's slapsticky enough for, say, an 8 year old, but it actually talks about a lot of themes of the day. I was surprised how they were still making political statements, even though now, one of the notes I had for this movie is, the HR department would have fired every single one of these characters. If this happened now, it's right at the end of that, your boss chasing the secretary around the desk days.
Well, and how, with the exception of her kids, Lily Tomlin's kids, and Dorley's husband, Dwayne, every other man in this is this sleazy, icky, kind of nasty, chauvinist dork.
Oh yeah.
Even they're all kind of they're steely, or they're beady-eyed, or they're spying, or there aren't any real positive. There's no positive male role, and I'm fine with that. You're right. There was a lot of progressive thinking, but also Jane Fonda was in it. She wasn't exactly a shrinking violet on issues.
Well, so. Jane Fonda, I think this is her production company's maybe first movie they produced, and so yeah, she and Lily Tomlin were very involved in the whole process.
And well, that would make sense.
This was Dolly Parton's first movie.
And what a great debut.
Oh, yeah.
And God, how young she looked. She looks so far from where she looks today, but I see it's still Dolly, but wow.
Well, I will always think of Dolly Parton as looking like this.
Yeah.
I don't really, really even relate to the Dolly Parton or the Kenny Rogers. We'll talk about that later. Post plastic surgery. So, I had fond memories of it. So when I watched it again, I've now watched it twice in the last week in preparation for this. Because the first time when I watched it, I just simply watched it for pleasure. I wasn't, you know, again, I was surprised at a lot of things that we'll talk about. Not that anything really, again, as a kid, I'm sure I just watched it as a slapstick comedy. But there are some fun little political statements in here.
There's a lot of political statements in here. Plus, this is a very, very active movie.
Yeah. Yeah. So are we going to dive into the plot now?
Sure.
Okay. So first of all, actually, before we get to the plot, I set up, hey, let's dive into the plot. But now I'm going to tangent off. This is for you, Anastasia.
and if you don't like it, leave us a message.
Yeah, exactly. Leave us a message at the 425 and then whatever the rest of the numbers are that I can't remember.
It is 425-243-9169. That number again, 425-243-9169.
Put it in your phone now and then call it when you're listening. That way, if you're listening in the middle of the night, you just have to reach over to your phone, hit your in your contacts list, not in a creepy way, and you can chat to your heart's content with our voicemail.
Yeah, well, we don't care. You can call whenever.
Exactly.
I can always do that.
Drunk dials are the best.
I would love a drunk dial. That would be the greatest.
It would be the greatest. So if you could please drunk dial us. So, okay, so we can both agree we like 9 to 5. Anyway, we'll see you next week when we... No, I just wanted to take a tangent completely away and never get to the plot of the movie, which would be hilarious.
Let's move on to another movie.
Exactly. So, anyway, so the movie opens with the 9 to 5 theme song that
and I don't a really long open, by the way.
A really great opening. Drew turned me on to this podcast whose name I won't remember. Oh, no, it's called There Will Be Spoilers, I think. And it was the When Pop Music Is Really Smart episode, where this guy talks about the song Time After Time being really good example of good writing. Well, this opening theme, or sorry, this the opening credits sequence to 9 to 5 is brilliant in that way. You've got the theme song, okay, that tells you about the whole drudgery of being a 9 to 5 working woman. But then you have all these scenes. It starts out with the alarm clocks ringing. It's got all these scenes of people walking in time, like they're setting the time. They're looking at their watches. There's a whole sequence where that was really beautiful that kind of focused on this storefront that had some metronomes going back and forth. The whole opening is all about time.
Bed and I stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets, the traffic starts jumping with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living. Barely getting by, it's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind.
And it's lovely. And the song is fun. And I think the song actually charted pretty high.
Yeah. Well, and that and the song is kind of like, it's almost like a sitcom song where it sums up kind of in briefly a little bit of the plot to give you some foreshadowing. So they don't have to tell that part of the story. You kind of get immersed into the whole atmosphere by the opening song.
Exactly. Because like you could have done a whole episode, which I believe they did, where it talks about how she was working in a beauty shop in Flushing, Queens, and her boyfriend threw out in one of those crushing scenes. What was she to do? Where was she to go? She was out on her fanny. So over the bridge from Brooklyn to the Sheffield's door, she was there to sell makeup, but the father saw more. She had smile, she had flair, she was there. That's how she became the nanny. And who would have guessed that this girl we've described would be exactly what the doctor prescribed? Because the boss found her beguiling, watch out CC. And the kids were actually smiling. Such joie de vivre. She was the lady in red when everybody else was wearing tan. I think she was the crushing girl from Flushing. the nanny named Fran.
Now, what isn't in your head that should be that that's taking up the space out?
Well, that is a problem. I mean, I don't know where my... In fact, I spent an hour looking for my wallet the other day.
No, I joined that club. I can still... We talked about this now that we're tangenting again. We talk about this where I work, where I know drug codes in my head now. Off the top of my head, I can rattle off what the national drug code for a bottle of omeprazole 20 milligram capsule Dr. Reddy brand is. And your wife will probably laugh at this. I can rattle off, you know, our children's Tylenol, national drug code of that. I can rattle off several drug codes. I can still remember a single can of Pepsi barcode from when I worked at Fred Meyer. You know, I remember all these things. And then, like, I can't remember, like, what time I need to be at a meeting I have next week. Oh. I can't remember a phone number to save my soul anymore. So, you know, I remember stupid things that aren't going to do me any good. God forbid, you know, now that, of course, my cell phone is backed up online and my contacts are online, because if my phone ever died, I wouldn't be able to call anybody.
Well, and that's why when I did the nanny thing, I didn't want to look it up and just read it. I wanted to see if I could do it in my head, because if I looked it up every time, I wouldn't need to have it in my head, and that skill would be gone.
Oh, dear.
I mean, a lot of what I do for a living involves short-term memory. So, anyway, and dredging up long-term memory. Let me take a quick break, and then we'll actually get back to talking about this movie. So. Hold on just a second. Not in a Creepy Way, we'll be back after these messages. As always, we'd love feedback. Call us on our feedback hotline at 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. And we're back.
Okay, back to the plot.
Okay, so actually, yeah. By the way, did you recognize at all? I didn't recognize her, but I was curious who the blonde actress was in the opening credits. Because she
the coffee spilled on her teeth?
Yeah, she was not in the film, otherwise.
No, I figured she was just some extra.
But it was beautiful. I mean, you followed her all the way along, and then you transitioned right into our first character, Judy Burnley, played by the wonderful Jane Fonda.
Yeah, who they made as ugly as possible.
She made those choices herself. She went out and I think interviewed women who had gone back to work for the first time or had gone to work for the first time. And so like those glasses and the outfit she wore were right from her investigative process of being an actor.
Well, I mean, way for her to be both method and immersive, but wow. I mean, that was like some bad, I mean, even in the 80s, that was some bad outfit.
Oh, it was great. And those glasses, stunning.
I think our grandmother had a pair of glasses very similar to that.
I think pretty much everybody had a pair of glasses like that. Yeah, you're right, though. She wore the ones where the frames kind of started at the bottom and kind of dipped up. Yeah, she wore those for quite a while.
Yeah, and they would look good on her, though. I mean, I'm not saying that they were a bad fashion choice. And, you know, for our grandmother, she was fairly stylish in her attire.
Oh, yeah. Well, she went back to work, or she went to work, you know, after getting a divorce, which is what Jane Fonda did. Judy Burnley did. And then later, your mom, after taking time off to raise the kid, she had to go back to work. And so that was all, I'm sure it resonated in some way with her, too.
Yeah.
Although that was much later than this.
And mom actually mentioned that she really liked this movie a lot. And so she's probably going to have to watch it. And we'll hopefully listen to the episode. So if we swear a lot, mom, sorry.
It turns out she does listen, just not always right away when they come out.
Yeah.
So, and that's fine. I understand people have lives. And unlike the two of us, she's not listening to 24 other podcasts a week.
That's probably true.
So, now if we had a TV show, I'm sure she'd be watching it right promptly. Oh, who are we kidding? Everybody DVR it.
I was going to say it would go on their DVR and it would end up on her backlog of like 1,000 things to watch.
Yeah, that's true.
Although she does go through her stuff, but I got to say her prowess with the DVR, I can't run their television sets, so and I consider myself pretty technologically adept. I don't understand their system in any way. So.
Oh yeah, they've got it all fine tuned.
They've got something. But every time I'm there, Dad's like, "Hey, you want to watch TV?" I'm like, "No, I'm good."
No, that's funny. See, the other way, I'm like, "Yeah, I like to watch whatever you like to put on for me because I can't figure it out." Well, once the TV is on, I can figure it out.
I can turn it on. I can't manage to figure out because of the remotes. Which remote goes to which TV in which room. And so then it's a matter of, okay, then she's recorded something on one DVR, but I don't know which DVR is controlled by which remote and then how to get which DVR to play back on which TV. Cause they have multiple DVRs anyway.
Yeah. Plus they get digital signal from outside too. So
yeah. So I'm like I got my laptop unfit.
Yeah, exactly. Except they don't have good enough internet to stream very well. So anyway, so back to the plot of the movie. We meet Judy Burnley, Jane Fonda, who is forced to find work. By the way, of course, all plot summaries are by Wikipedia. Wikipedia, we're mostly right. She's forced to find work after her husband, Dick, played by Lawrence Pressman, who, by the way, was best known for being on Heart to Heart and Doogie Howser. He's got like 164 acting credits, so he's been around.
Oh, he's been in a ton of things.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And he's good as being slimy.
Yeah, because he's not usually a good guy.
Yeah, because he's got that slimy white guy face. So he squanders their savings, loses his job, and runs off with his secretary. So she's got to go out in the workforce. And she ends up going and becoming a secretary at Consolidated Companies, a very large corporation. And by the way, we have no idea what Consolidated Companies does, nor do we care. And they don't bother to explain it because it's not important to the story.
No.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I love that part of this movie. You never learn what this is about.
But I think that was in that was the brilliance in the writing, is that it could have been any company.
Exactly.
It could have been your company. I mean, I work for a big company. I mean, easily I can see in the 80s, I can see the office admin where I worked. I could have easily seen some of the shenanigans happening. Not, clearly not all of them, but some of that I can see going on.
Oh, I was going to say, they actually got the workplace relationships really, I mean, they nailed it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this is basically a workplace comedy. And they got the work. I mean, totally. You're absolutely right. The only difference between now and then is that we would have cubicles now.
Well, and you'd have a lot more HR intervention.
Well, exactly. Everybody in this place would be fired as of day three. But that's okay.
Yeah, there would be a whole lot more sensitivity and cultural awareness.
Which just shows in, 30 years where we've, 35 years almost, how far we've come. I mean, ultimately, this is a movie about... Well, okay, Jane Fonda's character is getting into the workforce, so she's a fish out of water. But when she works for Consolidated, when she's hired, she meets the senior office supervisor, who is a feisty widow, Violet Newstead, played by Lily Tomlin. And Violet is not a fish out of water. In fact, she's the most competent fish in the whole pond. The problem is, she's a girl fish, and she has hit the ceiling, and she's not happy about it.
And she knows it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she trained her current boss, Mr. Hart. And she's going to train all of her other upcoming bosses who are just going to climb right up the ladder where she can't. So she's bitter a little bit, but she has to put on a good face because she still wants to grow within the company. And she
clearly needs the job.
Yeah, everybody needs it. She's a widow with four kids. So, yeah, she's got a family to feed. And they're at least, I mean, we only meet one of her children, I think. And he's, I guess, hopefully an adult, but maybe not.
Well, you see the two kids, but you're really only introduced to the one, yeah.
Yeah, I guess through the window in the garage you see him.
Right.
So, so she's got four kids of her own. And that's two of the three main characters. And then you meet the boss, Mr. Franklin Hart Jr., Dabney Coleman. And Dabney Coleman, 170 acting credits, including a whole bunch of stuff. I didn't realize he's on Boardwalk Empire, but he was in War Games and... The Slap Maxwell Story, and there was another one that I think I might buy where he's like a television reporter or something. For some reason, I think of Dabney Coleman as just a little bit older with the pot belly, but he's pretty young in this and pretty fit.
He was.
So, anyway, he is obnoxious, and his executive assistant is named Roz, which, by the way, Roz is a good name for any character.
It is. By the way, she's still alive.
Elizabeth Wilson is?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I believe it.
Elizabeth Wilson.
Yeah, she's the resident snitch in the office, and also Mr. Hart's right-hand woman.
Kind of, yeah.
Although she's not very close. You know, that's the thing. She's not close in proximity to Mr. Hart. She just likes to snitch on other people to him.
And not seemingly full of any kind of responsibility, because you never kind of know what she's doing.
That's true. And it's not like I don't think she and Mr. Hart are friends.
No.
She's just the snitch, and that's what her place in the company.
Yeah.
So Violet's showing Judy around.
This way. This is quite a day for me.
I bet it is.
I was so excited. I left an hour early so I wouldn't be late.
Uh-huh.
I'm certainly glad I did. It took me 45 minutes just to find a parking place.
Right here. Well, we park inside the building. I'll show you how to punch in.
And I just moved to a new apartment near the airport.
Huh.
Hey, Violet, what it is?
Oh, hi, Eddie.
What do you hear about your promotion?
Nothing right now. Eddie Smith.
Judy Burnley.
Judy starts work today.
What? Look, how am I ever going to get out of this mailroom prison if they keep hiring people from the outside? Lady, you're going to hate it here.
Then we meet the third of the trio of heroic women, Mr. Hart's buxom secretary, Dora Lee Rhodes, played by Dolly Parton. And everybody thinks she is sleeping with the boss, but in reality, she's happily married and just kind of brushes him off every time he makes a pass at her. But Hart leads everybody to believe that she's having an affair with him. And this is the part, I mean, it's actually, they make a point of showing Dora Lee as being ostracized by the other women in this organization. So it's a little bit sad, and that, first of all, makes you like her, and second of all, helps with that capturing the office politics and relationships. Because Judy wants to like everybody, she's brand new, she's happy to meet everybody, but as soon as she finds out that Dora Lee may be sleeping with the boss, she doesn't want anything to do with her.
Right, she instantly ostracizes Dora Lee.
Yeah, and Dora Lee has to eat alone in the lunchroom.
But part of that, though, is because Judy's husband just left her for another woman.
Oh, exactly.
So now she's coming face to face with an adulterous situation in the workplace that she, you know, she needs to keep the job. So then it's the cycle of, you know, I have to kind of swallow it and be happy about it.
But you're right. And Violet doesn't like it because Violet's trying to get ahead. And if she thinks you could get ahead by sleeping to the top, that's not acceptable in her book either. Anyway, so I thought that was actually pretty good. Now, again, this is Dolly Parton's first film. I guess in preparation, she memorized her own part and the parts of every other actor in the film. And when Lily Tomlin and Jane Fonda found out that she thought the film was going to be filmed in chronological order, they thought she was hysterical.
Well, you've never been in a movie before, though.
Oh, no, absolutely. I'm sure it was completely an honest mistake. I mean, how would you know?
Right.
So Hart, Dabney Coleman, is just awesome. He is chewing the scenery, and he is a bad guy. He takes credit for everybody's work. He's the boss that you hate.
Yeah. No, he's the 80s get-ahead, cutthroat, top-of-the-stack businessman who absolutely takes credit for everybody else's work.
Oh, it's great. I mean, he's a perfect version, and I'm sure everybody's had a boss like this to some extent or another. Just as everybody's known somebody who had to eat by themselves in the lunchroom. So we continue to see these. We meet all the characters, and there's some moving around so you can see what everybody's role in this whole thing is.
Yeah.
And in the big piece of slapstick, we get Judy in the copier room,
which is hilarious.
And I just love the fact that A, copiers were that big, and how Violet says several people have lost their hearing in this room. And then other than the grunts when the copier starts shooting paper all over the place, I thought it was just very well done. And the giant collator, I love that.
Yeah, well, if you've ever worked in an office with an industrial machine, though, I mean, those machines still exist, by the way.
Oh, no, I realize. And you would be as befuddled as she was.
Oh, yeah. When I was running payroll and printing paychecks for the company, my Xerox printer was this 35-foot-long, huge printer that printed 3 sheets per second. It's pretty fast. 180 pages a minute. It was paychecks, and we had to print paychecks because we, you know, 100,000 paychecks every week. So you gotta be speed. So if that thing jammed and at any point, and when it was printing, and there was paper everywhere in that machine, you had to clear like 17 different spots of jams.
I bet you it was so hot in that room, too.
Well, we had to get a dedicated air conditioner just for the room, because what happened is, because it, you know, printer toner, laser toner is about 420 some degrees to melt the toner onto the page, because toner is just plastic. So yeah, no, it gets hot pretty quick. And when you're running it sustained for 6 hours a day to get your paychecks out, that room heats up pretty quick, and heat affects paper and paper would jam. And so I look at this movie now, having experienced all kinds of printer maladies, and it makes me like cringe and laugh. And like that could have easily, like I've been there. Like I've been there when the machine's just spitting stuff out, and you push a button, it just spits more stuff out at you. And you're like, I should not have gotten out of bed today.
Exactly. At a certain point, you got to think, okay, can I just unplug it? I mean, is that possible? But in a machine like this, you wouldn't even know where to find the plug.
No, and there's no off button.
Yeah, and it's hilarious. It might not even be a 110 source. It could be like a 220 source or something.
Oh, mine? No. Mine was a huge, yeah. It had three power cords.
Yeah, I'm sure. All right, each on their own different circuit, so that if you had a breaker problem. Anyway, yeah, this is beautiful. And, of course, they added the extra sound effects, and they had people shoving out, or using compressed air or something to push out the paper so fast out of the collator, but still, too funny.
Yeah.
And then it comes from funny slapstick to Dabney Coleman is trying to impress his coworker and wants to take him to the copy room to tell some sort of scam he's doing, and finds her... Judy has, like, screwed up this whole thing and just berates her horribly.
Right.
Yeah. And we've all had a boss like that, too. So, yeah. So he's not a nice guy. We're getting to know this. So eventually, one of the girls that they hang out with or they talk to is named Maria. And she ends up in the bathroom. This is all happening off camera. Roz comes in to tell Hart that Maria was... talking about her salary and other people's salaries and trying to guess at people's salaries, which I guess is against company policy. So Hart is just like, fire her. And Roz keeps trying to like justify it. And he's like, no, fire the bitch. What else do you have to hear from me? So this all comes to a confrontation. Oh, by the way, I love Margaret, who's the office drunk.
Yeah, the lush.
Yeah. How charming is it that she's the comic relief character?
Well, and what's her stock line? That a girl?
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah,
but you know, at the end, she comes back at the end, and it's a beautiful scene.
Yes, there's a redemption.
Yeah, which is pretty great because it's a character they easily could have forgotten.
Yeah,
but they did the work on this movie. That's what I'm saying.
They brought Maria back too.
Yeah, this all comes to a head, and I'm gonna drop in a big quote here because it takes two of the three women, it puts them in the path that they're all going to need to go on. And this is when Violet doesn't get her promotion.
What?
Now let me finish, okay? And don't go flying off the handle.
You gave that promotion to Bob Enright instead of me? I've got 5 years seniority over him.
I know that.
For Christ's sake, I trained him.
I know that, but see, the company...
Oh, the company bullshit. It's your decision. You promoted him. You tell me why.
Well... in the first place, see, Bob does have a college degree.
Oh, Violet. Brilliant. Brilliant. While he's away at college getting his precious, useless degree, I'm working my butt off at this company.
And in the second place, he does have a family to support.
And I don't? What has that got to do with anything?
Violet, look, my hands are tied here. The company needs a man in this position. Clients would rather deal with men when it comes to figures.
Oh, now we're getting at it. I lose a promotion because of some idiot prejudice. The boys in the club are threatened, and you're so intimidated by any woman that won't sit at the back of the bus.
Spare me the women's lib crap, okay? Now, I know how you feel, and I understand it.
You understand zilch.
I understand I'm still a boss here. And even though you might be pretty valuable out there, you better get a hold of yourself. I'm not going to sit here and take this. God damn it. Dorley, get in here!
Okay.
I told you 6 weeks ago to have this chair fixed.
Okay, I'm going to leave, but I'm going to tell you one thing before I go. Don't you ever refer to me as your girl again.
What in God's name are you talking about? Dorley, now what are we going to do about this chair?
I'll tell you what I'm talking about. I'm no girl. I'm a woman. Do you hear me? I'm not your wife or your mother or even your mistress.
What?
Mm-mm. I am your employee. And as such, I expect to be treated equally, with a little dignity and a little respect.
What do you mean, mistress?
Never mind, she's just a little upset.
Dorley, just come off it, for God's sake. The whole company knows you two are having an affair.
Who's been saying we're having an affair?
Who's been saying it? He has.
What?
Violet, where are you going?
I'm gonna get drunk.
That a girl.
So you've been telling everybody I'm sleeping with you, huh?
No.
Well, that explains it. That's why these people treat me like some dime store floozy.
No,
they think
not.
I'm screwing the boss.
That's not it at all.
Oh, and you just love it, don't you? It gives you some sort of cheap thrill, like knocking over pencils and picking
Dora,
up papers.
Babe, now, let's don't get excited.
Get your scummy hands off of me. Look, I've been straight with you from the first day I got here, and I put up with all your pinching and staring and chasing me around the desk because I need this job, but this is the last straw.
All right, now, wait. Let's just sit down and...
Look, I got a gun out there in my purse, and up to now, I've been forgiven and forgetting because of the way I was brought up, but I tell you one thing. If you ever say another word about me or make another indecent proposal, I'm going to get that gun of mine. And I'm going to change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot. Don't think I can't do it.
Shit.
Where are you going?
I need a drink, Roz. I'm taking the rest of the day off.
Atta girl.
So it's two monologues in a row, and then Judy finds out that Maria has been fired, and she wants to tell Violet about it. So they all end up going to this bar to get drunk. And this is when the hilarity and kind of mayhem ensues, because, of course, Violet, we know, she is handy. She put her own garage door opener in, and her son, hopefully her eldest son, but anyway, gives her a single marijuana joint. So she can mellow out because she's so stressed from work. So she finds this in her purse as she's buying another round of drinks with the girls. And they all retire back to Doralee's apartment because her husband is out doing a gig. And, you know, I don't have any drug history to speak of, but they really got a lot of mileage out of that one joint, didn't they?
Well, I mean, but they're drinking and they've been drinking. So there's no telling how altered they already were. They started drinking because it was like the middle of the day, I think.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, they all left during the middle of the workday.
But it was night by the time they were at the house when they started smoking. So, you know, I think they had been well into their cups. But the best thing about that is that their laughter is so infectious. It makes you laugh. They are so... I actually wrote down infectious pot laughter on my...
Oh, yeah.
Because it was like, it's so... They're so... well acted, and I don't know if they liked each other on the set. I don't know if there was any chemistry between them, but they seemed to they would be hilarious together. The characters, I don't know if the actors would be, but these three characters are hilarious together.
Well, I hope they liked each other because they certainly look like they're all having a good time.
Yeah.
And that's, again, where, you know, Lily Tomlin and Jane Fonda were name brand actors at this point, and Dolly Parton is a country singer, so she knows about performing. But who knows what other kind of acting she's had. Maybe she was, you know, did hee-haw skits or Grand Ole Opry things. But she certainly wasn't a film actor until this movie. And she kept up with everybody.
Yeah.
So during this little pot party they have, where, by the way, why does Doralee have construction paper in her apartment? Because after one of the fantasy scenes, you cut back and Jane Fonda's
Judy has the paper mache chain.
Yeah, the construction paper chain and the turkey or something?
Yeah.
Does Doralee have kids? Why would there be construction paper in this house?
I don't know. That's never really clear.
I just thought it was a weird choice, but fun. You know, it shows that they're coming back and eating barbecue and stuff. But
yeah.
Here's where we have three separate fantasies of how they would kill the boss.
Which are all great, by the way.
Oh, they are all great. It first starts off with Judy's fantasy of being a big game hunter.
Because she's horrified at the buck on the wall.
Yes, yeah. She doesn't get the idea, or she does not approve of the hunting in real life that Hart does. So she is hunting him in cartoon style. And what were those machines that look a little bit like microwave ovens against the wall? Do you have any idea?
Oh, you mean the speaker boxes?
Yeah, is that what they were?
Kind of like big boombox stereos.
Yeah, and they were all like the size of microwave ovens.
Dictation cassette machines.
And so they got them piped into their desk from there?
Well, I imagine that they would have to, I don't know, if they either checked the machines out or if they had to go listen to tapes and work at the stations close by, I would imagine. They look to me like the kind of dictation tape machines we had at the office.
Like a reel-to-reel kind of thing?
No, they were just cassettes, but they had speakers so that you could listen to audio. You could listen to them on the speakers, or you could put headphones on.
Yeah, because I know, you know, like Margaret was doing what, stenography? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Oh, anyway, she was like doing transcriptions or something.
Right. She was transcribing dictation.
Yeah. So anyway, because she had those headphones on, those transcription headphones.
Yeah. The cheap, like, airline headphone looking thing.
Exactly. I'm sure she had a foot pedal to start and stop the machine, too.
Yeah.
Oh, the good old days. Yeah. Now you just have Dragon's Beak or whatever.
Oh, God.
Although I'm sure there are still people doing transcriptions.
Well, yeah, they're outsourced. You have people in other countries.
Oh, could be, yeah. Absolutely.
No, seriously. Without naming names of anyone, I don't want to get them in trouble or where they worked in trouble, but there's somebody that we all know who listens to the podcast who worked for a company who their records were transcribed somewhere else. And it wasn't, I want to say it was overseas, but maybe not. Maybe I'm thinking of something else. You know, somebody I know has transcription service that is like done in India, and so sometimes the words that are used, like the people who get the transcription back, like, I would have never used this word because that's what the people who are transcribing think they heard.
Well, exactly. And if anytime you go into slang or jargon, you have a problem.
Well, and when people, yeah, I mean, when English is not your first language and you're transcribing English and you don't know what a word is and you don't know how to spell it and you try and do a search on the internet and you still can't get it, what do you do? Like, sounds like pigeon. I don't know.
Well, I think maybe you have an F key devoted to unintelligible.
No, that's probably true.
Yeah. And, you know, something, I mean, to tangent to outsourcing, this just makes me smile because I'm thinking of Anastasia right now, not in a creepy way.
I know. She's yelling at her headphones. Yeah.
But, you know, there are some things like, for instance, hospitals have gotten a little bit of press. I read a couple articles about the merits or problems with outsourcing radiology, and in a lot of cases, though, it makes sense just for time zone reasons. That way you can have radiologists that work regular office hours but all over the world, and so in the middle of the night, if you need to have your x-rays looked at, you just ship them electronically to where whoever's open, and that way you don't have to pay out people overtime.
Right.
So it makes a lot of sense from
Providence Health Systems actually does that in some way. I don't want to say they do it in all instances, but I know that when we had our hospital experience last November, we were waiting for the radiologist. They were like, you know, there's a radiologist who reads them. He's off site, but he needs to read them, and then he will get back to me. But it's all email.
Yeah. And I mean, because we don't care. I mean, really, if I'm in the hospital and I want to know whatever, like, my x-ray looks like, I just need someone to tell me what's the x-ray says so that we can do the proper treatment.
Well, and in this day and age, there's no physical media anymore. It's all electronic.
Yeah. And you're not going to, I mean, you're going to bill me whatever you normally bill me. So if you're going to save the money on paying overtime, that's your problem, not mine. Like, you know, your labor costs aren't my issue because you're not charging me based on your labor costs. Not in healthcare. You're not.
But you're paying for it all anyway.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Anyway, okay, so back to the movie. Now we have Doralee's fantasy, where he gets treated like the sex object. And that's just all kind of fun. And what was she holding? Like, some sort of, like hard writing crop or something? Is that what?
It looked like a walking stick.
It did, but it was very short.
Yeah,
it looked exactly. Would you hit an animal with that? I don't understand what that's for.
Maybe. It may have been some kind of herding implement.
Yeah, that's a little creepy.
It was beaky and sharp looking.
Yeah, it had, I mean, the top, you're right, looked like one of those walking canes that you would put your whole hand on instead of a knob.
Right.
But, exactly. It was a very short, anyway, it was weird. But anyways, it was lovely. I think it was the weakest of the fantasies, but still.
It made the ensemble.
Yeah. And then comes Violet's fantasy.
Yeah.
And this is where, in very Walt Disney fashion, she poisons him, and the little cartoon birds cheep, and they're all dressed in Disney princess getups.
And I got to say that Lily Tomlin has my vote for Snow White. I mean, she is the perfect Snow White.
Well, Lily Tomlin is darn near perfect in everything.
I agree with that.
I mean, you just want to give her a hug. Whatever she's doing, she's doing it right.
Yeah, no, everything she's ever done. I mean, I really, it's hard to think of something I've seen Lily Tomlin and then I didn't like. Even, you know, even some of the B movies like Bette Midler, which were not great movies, but okay movies. But
exactly. It's like
she had a run on West Wing. So
well, it's like Madeleine Kahn too.
Yeah,
you know, not all the movies were hits, but she's a hit in the movie.
I love Madeleine Kahn.
Yeah, I love Lily Tomlin too.
She's High Anxiety.
We will have to do High Anxiety soon. Because I remember liking that movie, but I haven't seen it probably since it was on cable way back in the day.
Okay. I own it on VHS.
Outstanding.
It is an old, 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 old movie. I think it was actually created before I was born, so since we're changing. But I love that movie. I really do. Because it's got so many great people in it.
Well, it's what, Harvey Korman and Mel Brooks.
Or Harvey Korman, Dick Van Patten. Mel Brooks, Madeleine Kahn, I mean, it really, yeah.
And it's lampooning all the Alfred Hitchcock movies, so that's awesome.
It absolutely is.
Because the source material is fun, so, you know, satirizing it is great.
And it's Mel Brooks.
Yeah. Okay, so then we get, of course, now the fantasy sequences are over, they've all had a good time, they show up at work the next day with, you know, they're all at least have each other. That's what they've come out of this experience with. Violet doesn't have her new job, and you know, Maria still doesn't have a job. Nothing is really solved except now they know they can go out and get drunk every night or get stoned or whatever.
And they know that Doralee is not a hoe.
Exactly. Now they have a member of their group. Now they're even stronger. They're women united, but not in a creepy way. Unfortunately, though, I mean, Violet is still irritated that Mr. Hart's such a jackass. So when he yells for coffee, she's irritated, and she has done, as we have led up to this, she has done shopping for the office, and she accidentally mixes up the box of Skinny and Sweet, which is the Splenda of the time, and rat poison.
The Rido Rat.
It is the Rido Rat poison.
That's one of my favorite props of the whole movie is the Rido Rat.
I think Skinny and Sweet is hilarious too.
Yeah, that's true.
So she accidentally poisons his coffee just like her dream. So he goes in and before he can drink the coffee, though, his chair, which has been broken this whole time, knocks him over. And before he can drink the coffee, he hits his head in the credenza and is knocked unconscious. But Violet does not know that. She thinks she has just poisoned her boss. So she tells the rest of the girls and the trio go down to the hospital. And this is for Caper number 2. And I love the score of all the hospital scenes because it is truly all like caper music.
I actually wrote down hospital music is so awesome.
Oh, it is. It's so fantastic.
Because it's Hitchcockian.
Absolutely. And Violet is freaking out. And so, of course, mayhem ensues. They mistakenly think that Mr. Hart has died. So Violet steals the body. And of course, it's not the right body. So, and what kind of car? What, it was a Buick, right? They were driving around?
Yeah.
She was getting a lot of fun driving time in the Buick. When Violet gets stopped by the candy striper in the hospital and asks where the coffee shop is.
Excuse me. Could you tell me where the coffee shop is, please?
What?
The coffee shop.
The coffee shop? No, I'm new here. I don't drink coffee.
I'm new here, too. Where do you work?
Downstairs.
In the morgue.
That's right.
Then he's...
Yes, he is.
How did he...
Coffee. Too much coffee. I'm just taking him out for some air. I mean, some fresh air for me. He's just coming along for the ride. What?
You're a doctor. I didn't see your badge. Sorry.
I'm a doctor. So why the hell am I talking to you? Piss off.
Yeah. It's so funny.
Yeah, this is great.
Yeah, and also, you would never get away with that today anyway, but funny. So, they have this whole thing where they end up stealing the body, and then they find out it's not Mr. Hart's body, so they have to drive it back at the hospital.
But they have that whole great scene, though, where Doralee goes to the back of the trunk, or back of the car in the trunk.
Yes.
Like, Judy, honey, could you come back here for a moment?
Yeah.
You know, they're like having a little conference, and then they call Violet back, which is, it's like, you know. But then Violet's so cool about it. She's like, we'll just take it back.
Oh.
After having meltdown, she's just like, no, we'll just take it back.
And then they get stopped by the cop, of course.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of fun. It was funny because I was actually hoping, you know, they end up leaving the body in the, you know, like a bathroom in the hospital.
Right.
And the housekeepers or the janitorial staff finds it, and it's just two like older black ladies.
Yeah.
And I swear I thought what they were gonna say, like, Rose, they left another white woman or white guy in the bathroom. You know, these white people be dead white people be showing up everywhere. But they didn't. So I was happy about that.
Well, it was the 80s.
Well, but they didn't even mention it, which I thought was great. Because I thought, you know, it was the 80s, or it was just 1980. It was still the 70s.
Yeah.
So it could have easily done that kind of thing.
But the implication, though, was that this wasn't an uncommon thing.
Oh, no. That was the funny part. It's like, it's just another dead body in the bathroom.
Yeah, but it wasn't just a dead body. It was a dead body with, they'd already covered it up. So it was, like, dead shoved in a corner body.
Yeah, not ideal, but funny. But I'm like I said, I'm glad they didn't play the race card in this one. Because why? It was not necessary. Now, in a Mel Brooks movie.
Never necessary.
Well, yeah, but in a Mel Brooks movie, they would have done that. I'm just saying.
Well, but that's Mel Brooks.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Just different sensibilities.
Right.
But you'd expect more when Jane Fonda is at the helm. I'm just saying. Because she made it by the director, but she's producing it.
Yeah. No, there's some influence.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm just guessing. Who knows? Maybe Colin, what's his name, is a very progressive guy.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, he wrote Harold and Maude. That was kind of fun.
Really?
Well, you didn't think that was a fun movie?
No.
I think it was a sweet movie.
I hated that movie.
Oh, well. Again, I haven't seen it in a while. I think it's the one I watched with Terry, you know, at her suggestion. So, but I remembered liking it. So, and Ruth Gordon. Who doesn't like Ruth Gordon? Okay. Maybe Brother Jay doesn't like Ruth Gordon. Who knows? Not in a Creepy Way. We'll be back after these messages. As always, we'd love feedback. Call us on our feedback hotline at 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. And we're back. So Violet, Doralee, and Judy come to work the next day because they don't have anything else to do. And Hart turns up. So they all go to the ladies' room and they're freaking out and speculating on what could have happened and how this, you know, what's going on. And they vowed that they would never speak of that thing again and it's all over. But of course, Roz is in the bathroom stall as promised before. And so she writes down all this stuff on toilet paper and takes it into heart.
In true snitch bitch fashion.
Exactly. Did you have any thoughts at all about Evie?
About what?
Remember when Evie is locked up in V for Vendetta and she finds a toilet paper diary?
No, I didn't equate that, but...
Yeah, well, until just now, because writing on toilet paper seems like a very seldom done thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, unless you've got, certainly not in my office, you couldn't.
Well, yeah, my that's clinic, true.
I mean, my clinic, you couldn't, there's no way. Once you've got any kind of product that had any kind of moisture attached to it, it disintegrates into nothingness. It's like rice paper, really.
Obviously, you don't subscribe to the, my men use matcha wipe, or they use nothing at all.
I'm not even sure what that means.
You don't remember the SNL skit about Macho Wipe? It's the toilet paper. It was toilet paper. There's actually sandpaper on the rolls. And you can get them in different grits. And the end of it was, all my men use Macho Wipe. Or they use nothing at all.
Ugh, that's so repellent.
Yeah, but funny.
Ugh.
It's poop humor. Poop humor. It's been a sure thing for millennia.
Okay.
Yeah, so now Hart knows that these girls have plotted to kill him. Or almost killed him. So he's going to use this to his advantage. And what advantage is he going to do? He's going to sleep with Doralee. So he tells her basically she's going to show up at his house and it's going to be great. And it doesn't matter because he's going to go to the police. So she ends up basically hogtying him with the phone. And that's where slapstick number 3 comes in when they end up taking Mr. Hart to his house. Because his wife is on like an 8-month cruise? Eight-week cruise.
Yeah. Yeah, 8 weeks. But you realize at this point, after Doralee ties him up, and then Judy comes in and takes her pot shots with the gun, that now all three of them have actually fulfilled their fantasies.
Oh, exactly. You're absolutely right. That's funny.
Because, you know, Violet poisoned him, and Doralee tied him up, and Judy shot at him.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right.
They've all come full circle, which is hilarious.
So they end up bringing him home. and keep him in prisoner. And they have to figure out how to keep him prisoner, so they go shopping. And that's when, you know, the probably most memorable, I guess, prop, if you will, or setup from this movie is he is in a
garage door bondage outfit.
Yeah, he's like in a hang glider harness attached to a garage door opener with like leather wrist cuffs.
So yeah, as an 8-year-old, I'm exposed to garage door opener bondage media.
But it's so funny because hitting that garage door and having him suspended is so hilarious.
It was funny that I remember laughing at it then, and I still laughed at it. It's genius. And of course, you know, these ladies are certainly experts in bondage because they knew exactly what to do and how to do it. And so, you know, like, what exactly are these ladies doing when they're not at work? Because,
oh no, I mean, you know, Doralee has the roping skills and Violet has the garage door opener skills, and you know,
Judy's in M&M's.
Yeah, exactly. Judy's got the M&M's with her boss, which is pretty hilarious. So they decide that they're just going to keep him. They want to search for some sort of thing they can use against him. Because right now they've actually kidnapped him. They didn't intend to poison him, so they probably could have gotten off with that. But now they have actually all committed felonies.
Right.
Yeah, actually several. Yeah, wrong. Yeah, kidnapping. And then also firing the gun at him, which would be maybe, what, attempted homicide? Actually, a couple of different counts of kidnapping, because Doralee kidnapped him just by tying him up, and then they took him like to the separate location. By the way, people, stand your ground. Never get taken to the second location. That's the rule. He should have fought till they shot him right there. But then where would the movie would have gone? Yeah, this is not Taken. This is 9 to 5.
Is that the advice, though, in general in Alaska? Don't go to a second site.
Actually, it's the advice all over the world that I know of, but if to especially fathers of girls, but really it applies to everybody these days. If you get attacked and someone wants to drag you into a car, stand your ground. Do not get in that car. Kids who get into those cars never come back. Women who get into those cars never come back. Stand your ground, fight. If they kill you in the street, they kill you in the street. But chances are they're going to run off rather than, like, do you in right there.
Yeah, because then you be careful. You might turn a corner and this moose will be coming walking down the street at you.
Well, there's that, yes. Best scene in that movie, though, let me tell you.
It was the best scene in that movie. And for those of you who don't know what movie we're talking about.
Well, if you're not you're not a good listener of the program, if you have, well, actually, I shouldn't attack you if you listen to this episode.
Like, don't attack the listeners. Good God. Boy, way to turn on the audience. That was quick.
So what episode number is Frozen Ground?
I have no idea.
Okay, it's in the 20s, so search it out, people. It's great. We have a fun time.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the ladies now have, like I said, committed several felonies, but now they're looking to find an angle so that he can't, you know, turn them into the police.
No, they're looking for more blackmail.
Yeah. Luckily, they find it. They find out that he has access to this warehouse that is supposed to be full of inventory, and it is not full of inventory. It is empty. So it means he's been either selling it or somehow he's swindling the company out of a bunch of money.
Oh, he's been charging them for warehouse space that they're not actually warehousing anything in.
Yeah, something. So they're going to get the figures of what's supposed to be there from corporate office, and then they'll just turn them in, and or they'll hold it over his head, so it'll be a push. So,
except in the meantime, while they're waiting for the paperwork, they've got to keep him captive, but keep the appearance at work that he's still at work.
Yeah, which is actually pretty clever.
Absolutely.
And so they basically keep trying to throw people off. Turns out, since nobody really likes him, and he doesn't actually do anything except steal other people's ideas, he's not really missed except by Roz. So they decide to send Roz off to Aspen Language School to learn French.
Bonjour. Bonjour. Bonjour.
So they send Roz off, which is very clever, and they find out that hopefully their evidence will arrive about a week before his wife comes home from her cruise.
Missy.
And so they still have to keep him on ice for another 2 weeks, but they figure they can pull it off. So, or maybe even like it's almost a month at this point. But since they're there, they're like, hey, why don't we make all these changes in the office? You know, little things like allowing plants and photos on desks and doing flex time and all sorts of other things to improve the efficiency and the morale of the company.
Let's create a daycare system.
Exactly. All these things that we all wish we could have had. And by, you know, 35 years later, everybody should have. Well, some companies do that.
Very few.
Yeah, the daycare thing is tough. So during this time, of course, you know, they all have to keep shifts. Keep an eye on Mr. Hart, because he's kind of trying to escape. And actually, you know, makes a good go out of it. One time makes a great go of it.
Yeah, Doralee, because he breaks the luggage stand to try and get at the...
Well, he also, exactly. He also tries to cut through with the file that he's found in the bathroom, try to cut through his bonds.
Right.
But, so Judy discovers a prowler outside the house. And who's the prowler? But Dick, her ex-husband, whose marriage to the floozy has lasted only a week. So he wants Judy to come back to him. And he's a hardcore stalker. He's been stalking outside this house, making sure she doesn't, isn't shacking up with her boss or anything.
Yeah, and so can I say that this is the only part of the movie that doesn't ring true to the movie to me. This part of the movie, this subplot, I don't understand. I mean, I guess it's one way of, she's liberated. She's liberated herself. Now she's a single woman and she doesn't need a man. So it's kind of the social commentary, but it just didn't flow with the movie.
Yeah, I can see where that, I mean, to me, it didn't really knock me out of it, but I could see where, you know, this was the big moment for Judy's character to say that, hey, she's into everything. She smokes pot. She's into M&Ms with her boss.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I get that. I mean, it's really kind of her, she has arrived, you know, her coming out, if you will, but the other characters don't kind of experience that kind of same metamorphosis. And so maybe this movie was predominantly written with the Judy Burnley character in mind, but, you know, she's the only character that kind of has that payoff. The other two don't. And so it just kind of, like I said, that part of the movie didn't quite ring true to me. Plus, I don't like the guy anyway. You know, Dick, you know, you're not supposed to like him, Dick. But
oh, yeah. Well, she also shouldn't have just readily let him into the house. She should have shot him as a burglar.
Well, except that she as a character, was constantly doing the nice thing, even though it was against her own interests.
Oh, and true. And as a 1980s woman who had never worked before, she's not even, you know, she's just finding herself.
Right. And so that's, I think her letting him in and then letting him basically get whatever he wants to a point, that seems like very true to her character. Until she gets pushed to the point where she's like, I've had it.
And you don't think it works quite as effectively as it should have? How would you have written it different?
Well, I'm not sure what the... It, to me, it's like there's something missing. There's some part missing. It worked. It didn't ring quite as true as the rest of the movie. Because it kind of gave... You know, it was just kind of a larger segment of the story devoted to Judy's character. Which isn't a bad thing, but it seemed kind of imbalanced in proportion to the rest of the film.
Because you kind of think that... Even though this is technically Judy's movie, I mean, she's the first character introduced. She's our introduction to this world. But it should be really Violet's movie.
Right.
Yeah. I could see that. And you could actually have cut out the whole scene with Dick at the house, and it wouldn't have made any difference.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. But I get that this is kind of a social commentary. You know, because it is a very, well, not even very tongue-in-cheek way of saying, you know, I don't need you anymore. I don't need you. I'm a woman. I'm empowered. We're divorced. You left me and now you're coming back and you want things the way they were because you screwed up because you couldn't keep it in your pants. And guess what, Buster? I don't need you. So get lost. So, and I appreciate that. And that's a great message. And so I'm not saying it's a bad part of the movie. I'm just saying in the movie itself, you could have not had that in the movie, and it would have detracted not from the movie in any way.
Hmm.
But I understand that it, you know, again, the social commentary aspect of it, it was good for the time, and certainly, it was a good message. So.
Well, you know, very interesting, because I hadn't considered all that, but it makes a lot of sense. Very interesting, Brother Jay.
Apparently, I thought more about this as a social commentary than maybe I did when I was eight. So,
well, of course, I mean, you're absolutely right about that. But yeah, you know, because I guess that should have been the test: is that can this scene be just taken out of the movie and it be just as good as a movie? I guess yes, except for the Judy character did need to have some kind of power. Although I guess Doralee never really got her moment.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well. Anyway. So, of course, the plan thinks it's going to come together, everything's great, but turns out Missy his adoring wife, played by Marianne Mercer.
Great character, by the way.
From Mary Hartman. And also, the show, there was some sort of work show that had Anne Gillian in it, where she was in it also, and there was a, I don't know if they were cocktail waitresses or something, but I think there was a piano player.
Yeah, like a restaurant on top of a building.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a piano player with the big tip jar thing.
I remember the concept, and I know I've watched episodes of it, because I can recall an episode where, of course, there was some terrible fire, and they're all trapped on the top of the dam, on top of the dam building. But I don't remember much else. But I think you're right. It's Anne Gillian and.
Yeah, I forget the. I bumped into the name of it. I was doing research for the show, and I was one of those things where I looked it up because I didn't recognize the name, but I recognized, I think, the cover. And
my friend Robert has just written down, "It's a Living," is what he said.
It's a Living, yes, so, absolutely thank you, right. Robert. Yes, thank you, Robert, and welcome, Robert, to Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the brothers Anderson talk about movies. We probe deeply. Connie wants me to take the "We pull the baby out" because she finds it too creepy.
Yeah, no, I find it pretty creepy too.
Yeah, I got to think of something else though. I don't know. We'll figure it out.
Yeah, I know. It's definitely something we need to work on.
Yeah, but it's a process. So, okay, so
pulling the baby out is a process. Yes, pulling the baby out is a process. Yeah. Right?
Well, if I could somehow just work episiotomy and ointment and moist into the whole thing, it'd be fine. But I can't. And it's probably for the best that I don't.
I hate the word moist. It's so gross.
So many people do.
Panties is the other word. It's gross.
Oh, gross. There's something special though about moist panties. Anyway, we have Missy Hart's wife comes home early, and they only find out about it because she ends up calling Violet. No, who is it she called? I guess it was Violet, right?
Called Dora Lee.
Oh, I'm sorry. Calls Dora Lee.
Because she figured out that she was like, "Hey, it must have been you that sent me the flowers. I just realized I wanted to thank you, you know, because, you know, it was such a sweet gesture, and all those times it was you." And she's like, of course, Dorley's like, no, it wasn't me. And she's like, oh, I talked to Frank, and he said it was you.
Yes. And then somehow Frank convinced her that it was some sort of diet and exercise regimen with the garage door opener. Oh, yeah. Absolutely hilarious.
Because that's the kind of cover, you know, when your wife comes home early from a weekend where, you know, I'm not having a wife, I don't know, I'm making this up, but, you know, when your wife surprises you early on a weekend where she's supposed to be gone all weekend and she, you know, cuts it short, and then she comes home and you're, you know, in this bondage gear that you weren't supposed to have. No, honey, I tripped.
Well, exactly. Exactly. Well, he's already had experience with this because the wife has walked in on him and Dora Lee before.
I suppose.
No, in the very beginning when he gives her the scarf and pushes her down on the floor and then the wife comes in.
But that was, you know, he whacked his shit on the table, but this is bondage gear.
It's true. He's just upped his game a little bit.
He's escalated his behavior a skosh.
Well, and the funny thing is, you know, like I said, I think we've talked about this with pretty much every comedy, but the heart, I think, of comedy is to play it as straight as you can. So he is really not happy about being in this bondage situation. He's trying to get out, and he wants to have revenge. He's got revenge in his heart. And when Violet finds out that he's been out for at least 3 days, she knows what's already happening. He's going to replace everything that's supposed to be in that warehouse.
Because they did the, of course, show all their cards early kind of thing.
Exactly, as you would. Much like a Bond villain.
Exactly.
Yeah. So then, anyway, he ends up taking Dora Lee's gun and gets all three of them to go back to the office at gunpoint. Also, by the way, stand your ground, ladies. Let me make him shoot you right there. Do not go to the second location. Anyway, okay. So they all get back to the office. And, of course, he discovers immediately all the changes that happened while he was gone. And he is not having it. He does not like it at all. But before he can have everybody arrested and change it all back to where it was before, he meets up with the chairman of the board, Russell Tinsworthy. Now, I didn't recognize the face because there's a lot of Colonel Sanders makeup on, or, you know, facial hair on him. But did you recognize the name?
No.
Sterling Hayden plays Russell Tinsworthy?
Nope.
Sterling Hayden, who is Brigadier General Jack D. Ripper?
Oh, God, no, I didn't even recognize that.
Yep, put some Colonel Sanders hair on Jack D. Ripper, and you've got Russell Tinsworthy.
I didn't even connect the dots, but now that you say it, I see it. I'm
Oh, yeah. It's like I said, when I saw the name in the credits, I'm like, oh, wait, I know this name from a podcast.
Wow.
So he is there for the express reason of congratulating Hart for all the increases in productivity, which are done to the changes that, of course, the ladies did while he was in his bondage gear. Now, of course, he's way happy enough to take the credit for it, and there's a little bit of tap dancing in there. But then Tinsworthy, who is not a man who takes no for an answer, tells him he's moving up in the world and Hart's going to be promoted to take his new position in Brazil. But because, you know, he's not happy about this at all, but he's sort of trapped in all his web of lies. And this is where the movie ends, except for some little epilogue. Or I guess it's not really an epilogue. It's they just flash to what happens to everybody after the movie's over, which, by the way, I like that touch.
The quick exposition.
Yeah. So where at the end, Violet is promoted to vice president. Judy fell in love with and married the Xerox representative. And Doralee left Consolidated and became a country western singer. And what happened to Hart?
He gets abducted and never heard from again.
Yes, abducted by a tribe of Amazons in the Brazilian jungle.
Kind of offensive. You wouldn't really do that nowadays.
Well, you would have to really stress the fact that they're talking about Amazons in the sense of Amazon women. Like, I didn't get the impression that he... I mean, at first, maybe I got the impression he was attacked by a bunch of pygmies with bones through their noses and put into some sort of a pot to cook. But I think they meant, like, attacked by a tribe of fearsome women, which, of course, would make his life complete hell.
Yeah.
But maybe not. Maybe they thought the bones and noses thing. The Beatles haircuts and no pants. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No, not at all.
So, yeah. So, it's a lovely story of struggle and success and adversity and redemption. There's not really any love story in it, but it's not about that.
No.
It's about your place in the workplace and how Violet finally struggled through it. Because really, Judy's character doesn't come off. I mean, she ends up marrying the Xerox guy. That's not really a progressive thing. And Doralee, you know, becomes a country western singer. Well, she's adorable and has that great voice. Very specific voice. Dolly Parton has a very specific voice.
Yeah. No, you could pick it out of anywhere.
Oh, yeah. It's great. I mean, I'm not a country western fan at all by any means. But let me tell you, as a child, cue the Wayback Machine sound. As a child, I would listen to Herb Chainlin at night from 10 to midnight on KFQD 750 AM and his Public Opinion Hotline radio show. And so he would educate me and entertain me, and I would fall asleep, and the alarm would wake me up the next day for school at whatever ungodly hour, and it would still be on KFQD 750 AM because back in those days, your alarm clock was set to whatever radio station was, and you couldn't change it unless you did it manually. And 750 KFQD during the morning time was a country western station. And what was very popular during my childhood, at least maybe in, I don't know, 1980, 1982, whenever the song came out, Islands in the Stream, Kenny Rogers and Dolly Parton. A classic.
Written by,
hold on.
Pretty sure it was written by the Bee Gees.
Oh, it may have been. Yeah, I was going to say Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Andrew Lloyd Webber, really?
No, okay, I don't know. He doesn't. He doesn't even write the music, does he? Isn't it Tim Rice that writes the music, or is it Webber that writes the music?
I have no idea.
I don't know either. That's who knows. Again, Mr. Sheffield from The Nanny, his main competition, he was a musical director and producer, so his competition was Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Yeah. Islands in the Stream, yes, written by the Bee Gees.
Excellent. Yeah,
Barbara Streisand, the Bee Gees, and Chris Christopherson, they've written just about everything that exists.
And Barry Manilow.
Well, and then Prince.
Exactly, yeah. Fantastic stuff. So I woke up many a morning. I mean, I'm sure, in my memory, it's my own private Groundhog Day, where instead of I Got You, Babe, it would have been just Islands in the Stream that would have woken me up every single morning on my way to school every single day.
That's kind of awesome. So are we done with the movie?
Yeah, I think we're done with the movie.
Okay. I just want to make sure when we weren't so officially now. It is official Tangentville, so...
Okay. No, it's not a tangent now. We're off to different subjects.
Fair enough.
Yeah. It's not as fun. But now we have to start things that we tangent off to. Well, we don't have to, but that's how it's going to go, probably. So, you want to talk about logos?
Okay.
I was thinking about how to do a logo with all of our faces on it, or at least some representation of all of us on it. I did that logo that I put on Facebook that basically has Dad's old TV with our logo on it.
I thought that was Dad's TV.
It is Dad's TV, absolutely.
Okay. Because I was looking and going, that looks like the parents' living room.
Yep, it is the parents' living room with an old tube television. And I think like a Go Video VHS DVD combo thing below it. Yeah. But I photoshopped it up a little bit and put our logo on it and plastic wrapped it so it looks like it's on TV. I don't know if that's actually a good enough logo, but it made me smile to put that up there.
No, I think it's good. I mean, it looks good to me.
How's it going to look small, though? That's the problem. The advantage of having the very simple black logo with the lettering on it is that it's...
Well, I'm looking at it as the thumbnail. I mean, granted, I'm looking at it on a 60-inch television screen right now, but, you know, the little thumbnail looks fine.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, maybe we'll just keep it that way.
But I guess, to be fair, it's not the little thumbnail on my TV screen.
Yeah. Well...
It's a little small.
Maybe I can zoom in a little bit to it. See, originally, and this is what here's the one, and this is that was just a basically like a 15-minute like spitball thing. But what I wanted was maybe silhouettes of like three guys sitting on a couch and with a TV in front of them and like three microphones, or even just three microphones in front of a TV, something like that.
Well, I think maybe the next time the three of us are together, we should take such a picture.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if we really want a picture, but just some sort of representation.
In one moment. I'm posting another YouTube link.
Oh, excellent. Islands in the stream. That's what I'm posting. And of course, this isn't going to come out for like 3 weeks or something, so.
That's okay. It'll be historical. Because I have the Bee Gees, the Greatest Hits album. That came out a couple years ago, which is fantastic, by the way.
Well, it turns out the Bee Gees could both write and sing.
Oh, yeah. No, I am unashamedly a huge Bee Gees fan. So the DVD or the CD set, the two-disc set that was the Greatest Hits, it's just got some great tracks, especially because they're singing the tracks that they wrote that you didn't necessarily know they wrote, Islands in the Stream being one of them. And so you get their performance probably as they had intended the performance to be. So it's interesting to listen to songs that I've heard other artists do my whole life and then hear them do it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, for instance, the Nine Inch Nails song Closer, written by Alan Thicke.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's actually not true at all. It just made me laugh to say that out loud.
Yes, but Trent Reznor... then being ported to the late great Johnny Cash.
Oh yeah, well that was just brilliant. I mean, Rick Rubin, I haven't liked everything he's done as a producer. Like I didn't like the We Are the Champions Rick Rubin remix, but the whole Johnny Cash album is pretty amazing. And I'm not even a Johnny Cash fan.
Not really.
Well, I mean, he historically he's got some great songs, but I wouldn't go. It's like. Sort of like, say, Waylon Jennings. I'm not a huge Waylon Jennings fan either, but I mean, I recognize his place in music. But really, part of the Bee Gees, there's two reasons why I was never a huge Bee Gees fan. And one of them was, I was all into Kiss and stuff as a kid. So they were all anti-disco and Bee Gees were the heart of disco, or at least a big part of it because of Saturday Night Fever. So there's that. Also, all the rock... doesn't mesh like Andy Gibb just does not. That's like the alternate of what I was into as a kid. So being snobby and stuff, you just say, no, there's no way. But that's only reason one. Reason two is that can you sing along with the song Tragedy and even in the car?
Can I?
I can't even make my voice do that. Like not even in falsetto.
I make sure the windows are rolled up and
Undeniably, they could both sing and write. And again,
like I said, I'm unashamed in my Bee Gees love. So, but then then there's the whole I love the Michael Bolton too. So,
yeah, I don't really know enough Michael Bolton to even have much of an opinion. Like John Tesh, I don't know anything about John Tesh either, except or Yanni.
I love Yanni.
Yeah, don't care to. I mean, it's not really my type of music. I just figure.
Well, Yanni's one of those. Yanni's like Enya. You have to get an album you like. I don't like all of Enya's catalog. I don't like all of Yanni's catalog. There are a couple, like Yanni's Live at the Acropolis, if you listen to it from start to finish, it's great because it's very symphonic.
Well, it's like Pink Floyd, for instance. For all the cred you would have for being a Pink Floyd fan, I like The Wall and I like Dark Side of the Moon, but the rest of the stuff they did, not really fan of all that stuff. So
I agree with you. I've never been a huge Floyd fan.
Yeah, I mean, they did some great stuff, but yeah. But again, now that I'm older, I figure A, I'm not nearly as oh, I hate that. I'm more open to things like, hey, if I hear a Madonna song that I like, I'm going to be happy to say I like it.
Well, and I think now that I've matured to a certain point in my life chronologically, it's easier for me to go back and listen to a song that as a kid, I just like, oh, this is a terrible song. But now, like as an adult, I'm like, oh, I get it now.
Yeah, like Afternoon Delight, for instance.
Oh, God.
Or maybe not. But, you know, and also I found, and this is only a revelation to me, I'm sure it's not a revelation to anyone else, but you can like something, you can dislike something, but you can also have a third choice, and that choice is, well, this really isn't for me. It's not written for me. Like most rap music is not really meant for me.
Right. It's not terrible, but it's just not my thing.
Yeah. And, you know, like most polka music also, not for me. It's just not something I'm really interested in. Don't mind it. You know, I'm sure if I was forced to listen to a lot of polka music, I would find that I had preferences. But as a genre, there's no reason for me to you know, explore it too much. But again, it's all about time and place for me for music. You know, like I really like a lot of electronic dance music, but that's kind of, I think, that I like music with a fast tempo, and like something about oomph just does it for me. But
okay,
well, no, I mean, really, you know, you listen to like BT's Never Gonna Come Back Down. I'm not sure how you discovered that. I mean, again, I don't know if it was part of the soul coughing experience or whatever, but that is a freaking fantastic song. I love every part of it. I love the Paul DeCarli remix of it. It's just absolutely great. When I turn on the TV and see Coachella and Skrillex, I'm intrigued. I'm happy with that.
Oh, man.
Whereas I would never actually go to a rave, you know, and be around a bunch of people like that. But
well, you wouldn't go to rave anymore anyway. You'd go to somewhere where people have a bunch of headphones on and they're listening to their iPods.
Well, either way, you know, and they're listening to some guy's laptop. That's fine.
Yeah.
Hey, guy.
Exactly. You're listening to some dude's laptop who's multicasting.
Yeah, and the guy with the laptop and the light show, that's so that everybody's facing in the same direction. That's all.
Yeah. Multicast.
Which, you know what? That's all.
That was a callback. That was a callback.
Oh, it was a callback. I'm sorry.
Anyway. I tried to make the joke. You just bulldozed right over the top.
Oh, I did. You want to try it again?
No, it's okay.
Okay, yeah, sorry. Yeah, it was lost. That's the part where I'm not a great host here.
I'll just live in my wounded pride.
Here, maybe I can repeat it and as if I had said it first.
So now you're going to just steal my work.
Yeah, wouldn't that be great?
Okay, Mr. Hart.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. No, the best part of this is, it's funny, somebody at work, who I won't identify, had just started listening to it, to our little thing. And she's like, you know, I'm not sure who I prefer, Brother Jay or Drew. And I'm like, well, you don't have to pick. It's, you know, they're both great. I mean, there's no.
Yeah. I have a podcast listener, a pal of my own, who said this similar. I'm not sure if I like me better or Drew brother, and I'm not sure. I said, well, I think you have to take in this that he and I tend to watch very different movies, and so he is the kind of the counterpoint to my point in some ways.
Well, and at some point, by the way, especially when we get our stuff together and we can have all three of us on there, you know, at some point, you and Drew could actually do a podcast on your own. And then I was like, oh my God, that'll be the piece that, was missing, is that actually Eric was dragging you down.
Oh, I don't think I could do that.
Which would be hilarious. No, I would. Nothing would make me happier and sadder at the same time.
No, I don't think that's ever going to happen. I don't think that I'm going to make a pretty bold statement here, that I don't think there will be a point where Drew and I will do a podcast without you.
Well, you could, though.
That would be way too weird, because it's, you know, it was your you know, your genesis. So
I'm telling you, that happens a lot. You know, the star takes off and the person that started the show just gets left behind. That's fine. It's not a big deal.
No, we're family. We don't do that.
No, I'll be your Pete Best. I would be your Stuart Sutcliffe, but I'm not pretty enough, and B, I don't want to die of an aneurysm.
Wow, that would dart in place very quickly.
No, we need to do the movie Backbeat. Have you seen Backbeat? Well, then we need to see Backbeat. Backbeat is a great movie. It's fun.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll add that to the list at some point.
Well, okay. What kind of movie is it?
It's a movie about Stuart Sutcliffe, the singer for the Beatles before they actually got famous, like when they were just in the Cavern Club and then doing Germany. And he fell in love with the girl, I think, played by either Sherilyn Fenn or Cheryl Lee, one of the Twin Peaks girls.
Cheryl Lee.
Oh, yeah, Cheryl Lee. Yes, from Laura Palmer, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's a great movie. And is it Stephen Dorff?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's great as Stuart Sutcliffe.
Huh. How did I never hear of this movie?
I think it was kind of an indie thing at the time. Again, it's one of those things during... you know, like, I think Terry introduced me to that movie too. Great movie.
Oh, 94. That's why.
Oh yeah, perfect. Yeah, exactly. That time.
I would have been way too self-absorbed at that point.
Yeah, well, it's worth seeing. And, oh, and of course, I totally spoiled it for you because I told you that he died of an aneurysm.
Oh no, I won't remember.
Anyway, well, you realize that he didn't become a Beatle, so that part's pretty easy. It's based on a true story.
Yeah. No, this would have been right at the time. This would have been, my boyfriend at the time, this would not have been a movie in his wheelhouse, so we would not have seen this.
Yeah.
This would have not even been remotely on the radar of things we would have watched. So.
Well, you can't always just watch reruns of Urban Cowboy, and I have no idea what would have been the alternative in 1995.
Well, I think I hope I'm wrong.
It wouldn't
Outbreak,
have been
actually
Outbreak in the same year as Backbeat.
No, Outbreak's 95, Backbeat's 94.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But that gives you kind of a context of the kind of movies. Outbreak was a date movie for us.
Oh, okay, cool. So that
all the movies.
So like that scene in the theater where people are coughing. That's a good date movie, that's for sure.
I just remember, like, it was one of those. It was one of those, you know, rides home from the movie theater where I was just kind of like, that's not really how I wanted this day to end.
Yeah, well.
I mean, it wasn't the Schindler's List, you know.
Oh, no, I thought it was a great movie, though. But because I had...
No. I'm just saying, it's not like, you know, when my friend Debbie and I, you know, left the movie theater after watching Trainspotting together and was like, yeah, I'll call you tomorrow.
Well, yeah.
I need to go decompress.
You know what? We should do, let's do this at some point. We should do a list of movies that make you feel great at the end of it. Like, actually, 9 to 5 really has a nice, you know, you feel good coming out of it. But movies like, you know, if I remember correctly, Ghostbusters, you leave, you know, with the, of course, the end theme makes a big difference. But instead of feeling like you've been, you know, been through the ringer, like something like a Warrior or a Take Shelter. Or leaving the theater like you've been on some sort of crazed acid trip, like 2001.
Oh, God. I had to go there.
Yeah, or leave the movie theater thinking, oh, what? Say, Primer.
Yeah. Oh, terrible.
Or Source Code.
Oh, terrible movie.
Yeah, anyway.
Terrible.
But fun. Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on our new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts, dial it already.